This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I am Chinedu Ofor, and here's what's coming up.
We are going to produce enough to feed this nation and the surplus from the estimation that we have just done.
That was Zimbabwe Agricultural Technical Extension Services Director Stanchile Taparewa on how unexpected bumper harvests should ease widespread hunger and avoid food imports, saving foreign currency. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. It's been 6 months since conflict broke out in Ethiopia's Tigray region, pitting Tigray People's Liberation Front rebels against the military alliance of Ethiopian and Eritrean armies and associated ethnic militia. Thousands of people are believed dead and hundreds of thousands have fled their homes. Amnesty International says the world is not doing enough to stop the bloodshed. For more, VOA's Jason Patankin reached out to Amnesty's Ethiopia researcher, Fiseha Tekle, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Yeah, 6 months is an important benchmark, half year since the war has started. And even if the government has claimed that the war is over in November after capturing the town of Mekelle, the city of Mekelle, the war is still going on and the impact of the conflict is also really felt. Hundreds of thousands have been displaced, humanitarian access is seriously restricted. So we want to use this opportunity to highlight the dire human rights and humanitarian impact of the conflict. There are more than a million people who are in need of humanitarian assistance. The human rights impact is still there. We have seen crimes that might amount to crimes against humanity, which are not yet fully investigated. So we want to use this opportunity to highlight the importance and lack of proper response by the international community.
Now, just in the last couple weeks, the UN Security Council made its first statements about the crisis in Tigray, but it sounds like you don't think that statement was enough.
Yeah, that statement was encouraging, even though it came very late after the conflict has started. The Security Council was engaged on the matter starting from November, but they were not able to make this kind of joint consensus statement about the situation. It took them more than 5 months to come up with that such a statement. But in addition, we are not even yet sure if they are going to continue being engaged with the situation. There was no commitment from the Security Council. They didn't make any clear statement how they are going to react to the situation, especially about the human rights situation. So they have not come up with any concrete plan how they are going to react to the conflict.
And why do you think the international community has been slow to act and hasn't acted very strongly given the scale of the conflict?
Well, there are so many theories why that the international community and including the regional institutions like the African Union were not very strong about the situation. One is that the Ethiopian diplomatic leverage in these platforms, in these bodies of the regional and international organizations like the Security Council and the African Union. But we don't think that human rights and humanitarian situation should be subjected to political leverage or diplomatic threats. Instead, the Security Council should have been categorical at the beginning, including the AU, the African Union, and they should have spoken in unison starting from the beginning. So we still demand that the Security Council to stay engaged with the situation, to have a public dialogue and session on the situation, and they need to come up with a concrete plan how they are going to react to the situation.
Now let's look at some of the alleged atrocities. Can you go into what's taken place and also who is believed responsible?
I have to start saying that this is a very complicated war where there are so many actors, including the Eritrean forces, forces from the Amhara region, mainly the special police of Amhara region, and also militants called FANO. There is also the Ethiopian National Defense Force and the TPLF forces. We have seen a number of allegations implicating all the actors. in Western Tigray, forces loyal to TPLF in Maikarra, civilians being targeted and reprisal attacks against Tigrayans later after Maikarra was taken over. Amara forces killing the Tigrayans in many places in Western Tigray. In Aksum, we have seen joint operations that have targeted civilians that might amount to war crimes. In Aksum, we have documented a massacre committed by Eritrean forces in November 2020. And also we have seen shellings at civilian institutions and neighborhoods that might amount to war crimes. So there is a lot of evidence about these violations, including sexual violence in Tigray. But the information we have is the tip of the iceberg, even if it is very grim.
The Ethiopian government has variously denied and admitted to committing atrocities in Tigray, while the Eritrean government has rejected all accusations that its troops committed atrocities. The TPLF has also previously denied involvement in the Mai Kadri massacre. Also in Ethiopia, the European Union says it cannot reach an agreement with Ethiopian authorities on the parameters of sending an EU electoral observer mission to monitor the June 5th elections. The EU late Monday said as a result, its observer mission has been cancelled. Ethiopia delayed the parliamentary elections last year because of the coronavirus. At least 30 people were killed by dozens of gunmen in eastern Burkina Faso yesterday. The government says the attack occurred in Koumandiari province near the border with Niger. VOA's Friend to Africa service reports attackers rode into town and set homes on fire, then shot those who fled the flames. It was not immediately clear who was responsible for the attack. Burkina Faso has struggled for several years to contain attacks by Islamist militants linked to Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State groups. At least 60 people were killed in attacks in Burkina Faso in the past week. Najla al-Mankouch, the foreign minister of Libya's interim government, has urged Turkey to repatriate more than 20,000 foreign fighters and mercenaries from the battered country. Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlüt Cavusoglu responded at a joint news conference yesterday that Turkish forces were in Libya as part of a training agreement that was reached with the previous Libyan administration. Wolfgang Putzai, former Australian military attaché to Libya, discusses this development with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi.
Yesterday's very high-level visit is very remarkable. It takes place just 3 weeks after almost the whole Libyan government has visited Ankara. The delegation was led by Foreign Minister Cavusoglu, but included also Defense Minister Hulusi Akar and the Director of Intelligence Hakan Fidan. The Turks made very clear that they have no intention whatsoever to withdraw their military forces from Libya. Mangush has been the only one member of the GNU stating that the withdrawal of foreign forces and mercenary includes also the Turks. All the other statements from the GNU and from Tripolitania explain that they are in Libya because of a legitimate agreement. And after Mangush recently talked in Rome, in the public, in the parliament, about a dialogue with Turkey on the withdrawal of Turkish forces from Libya, she earned a very harsh response from the head of the High Council of State, Khaled al-Mishri, and from the Muslim Brotherhood. Mangush is pretty much without influence within the GNU anyway. The Baber deals with all the really important foreign policy contacts himself and sidelines Mangush.
The Vietnamese ambassador Dang Dinh, who chaired the UN Security Council's informal interactive meeting on the situation in Libya, urged the parties concerned in Libya to fully comply with the ceasefire agreement signed on October 23rd of last year. The closed meeting of the Security Council saw heavy arguments between the US and Russia on the Libyan situation and especially on Wagner Group mercenaries. What do you make of that in terms of the Russian intentions?
The Russians insist that they have no responsibility whatsoever for any of the foreign mercenaries in Libya, including Wagner. They underlined this in the Security Council by explaining that they voted also in favor of the recent UN resolution demanding a withdrawal of the foreign forces and mercenaries from Libya. When keeping the currently tense situation between Washington and Moscow in mind, I would rule out that President Putin will pressure or order Wagner to withdraw from Libya. The only one way to get the Russians out of Libya is a withdrawal of the Turks at the same time and the end of their financing by the Emirates. This is somehow realistic if one takes into account the challenging economic situation in Turkey. The deployment of the Turks in Libya costs a lot of money. And if there is another option for Erdogan to get his troops back and to get some face-saving economic benefits, I could imagine that he could go for it.
That was Wolfgang Pustai, former Australian military attaché to Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Elshenawy. The government of the Democratic Republic of Congo will replace civilian authorities with military administrations in two conflict-hit provinces in the east. The government in Kinshasa said late Monday the military administrators would run for a month in an effort to halt the worsening bloodshed in the region. Since the start of the year, a surge in attacks by armed militias and intercommunal violence in North Kivu and Ituri provinces has killed hundreds of people. The two provinces have suffered instability and violence since the 2003 end to the DRC's civil war. Tanzania's new president, Samia Suluhu, visited Kenya today and met for 3 hours with her counterpart, Uhuru Kenyatta, who said the two countries are ready to improve stalled relations. They signed a gas pipeline deal that runs from the port city of Mombasa to Dar es Salaam, a deal that will help Kenya cut the cost of doing business in its territory. Suluhu will also hold a business forum for the business community of the two countries. The abductors of students at Grenfell University in the northwestern state of Kaduna have threatened to kill the remaining 17 students in their custody if they're not paid a ransom of 100 million naira, or about $210,000 by today, the U.S. House of Service reports. The threat comes a day after reports that 17 villagers in central Nigeria's Benue state have been attacked by suspected Fulani herdsmen. Benue is a region that has been troubled by deadly clashes between nomadic Fulani herders and local farmers over land, grazing, and water for years. In addition, Reuters News Service reports that Islamist militants killed more than a dozen people, including 7 soldiers, in an attack in northeast Nigeria. The militants attacked the Ajiri community in the Mafa local government area of Borno State early Sunday. In addition to killing the soldiers, the attackers killed 6 civilians and looted and burned several buildings. Hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese children who have been deprived of an education over the past 14 months because of school closures returned to their classrooms for the first time yesterday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Children's Fund calls this a rare bit of good news and a major step in returning a state of normalcy for some 2 million children in South Sudan. The schools were closed in March of last year because of the coronavirus pandemic and because many were damaged or destroyed in the country's long-running conflicts. Speaking from the capital, Juba, UNICEF's chief of field operations in South Sudan, Mads Oyen, says the agency congratulates the government for making the decision to reopen the schools. He says schools offer a place of safety for children who are exposed to many dangers.
It gives them a status and it gives them a place also to come every day. So it enhances both their physical safety, their nutritional well-being because of school feeding, and it gives them that status as well so that they may not be sent to do, you know, other things, harmful work perhaps.
Oyen says it is too soon to know how many of the 2 million children have returned to school. He says it's likely many have not yet done so, especially girls, many of whom have likely become mothers or pregnant. He says UNICEF will be working to find these children and get them back to the classroom. He notes the humanitarian situation in South Sudan is very difficult and particularly bad for children. He says 4.4 million children depend on international aid for survival, the highest number since civil war broke out in 2013. He says 1.4 million children are expected to suffer from acute malnutrition this year, of whom 310,000 will be severely acutely malnourished and in need of therapeutic treatment to survive. He says children are at risk of dying from malaria, measles, and other diseases. He adds they also are faced with numerous protection issues.
Children are really disproportionately affected and exposed to multiple risks of violence, exploitation and abuse, and recruitment by armed groups still going on, psychosocial distress and family separation. Less than 1 out of 10 children have any access to psychosocial support and other child protection services.
In response to these desperate needs, Oyin says UNICEF and partners aim to scale up their humanitarian operations. Oyin says this depends on receiving the money required to carry out these life-saving programs. He says UNICEF's $198 million appeal is only one-third funded. Closing this funding gap, he warns, will have a direct impact on child survival. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
With good rains easing drought and a new conservative farming campaign being led by the government, Zimbabwe is on the cusp of a bumper harvest, which may change its long-standing food security issue.
Earlier this year, WFP said about 7 million Zimbabweans were food insecure. The drought was beginning to show even on the wildlife, which was running out of food and water in the world. But that is changing because of the good rains. Zimbabwe Agricultural Technical Extension Services Director Stancile Tapererwa says prospects for this year's harvest are promising.
We are going to produce enough to feed this nation and the surplus from the estimation that we have just done.
Information Minister Monica Mutswangwa announced the latest harvest projections.
Government is pleased to report that Zimbabwe is set for a bumper harvest following the above normal rains which have been received across the country during the 2020-2021 summer season. Highlights of the crop output projections are as follows. When it comes to maize production, it is estimated that 2.7 million metric tons, which is 199% higher than the 2019-2020 season. Then other traditional grains, we are projecting 347,968 metric tons, which is 128% more than the 152,515 metric ton output of the previous season.
Economic analyst Victor Boroma says a bumper harvest may go beyond easing food security issues.
That will translate to a significant benefit for the country. Zimbabwe was importing about 500 million worth of corn or maize from neighboring countries, Zambia, South Africa, and even as far as Ukraine and Brazil. What it effectively means is that the country would have sales in terms of foreign currency.
He says the manufacturing sector depends on agriculture for over 50% of its raw materials, mostly maize, wheat, sorghum, soybeans, and other crops. A bumper harvest means manufacturers will produce their goods for less because they are buying most raw materials locally. This harvest is a break from the past, something that Zimbabwe could use. The country has been food insecure for almost a decade due to poor rains and lack of skills among new farmers, and shortages have driven prices up, one of the major factors in the economy's downward spiral. For VOA, this is Kudzai Namashe from Harare.
Degradation of the world's oceans from global warming, pollution, overfishing and other factors is alarming many experts. But a study in the journal Nature outlines the benefits of creating marine protected areas over 30% or more of the oceans. One major step is to curb the use of industrial fishing trawlers, which plow the sea floor, catching nearly everything in its wake, while stirring up animal-based carbon deposited over centuries. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Nigerian-born Rashida Sumailer, an oceans and fisheries economist at the University of British Columbia in Canada. He spoke about the trawler's impact on economic and ecological sustainability.
Now, bottom trawlers are fishing gears, big industrial trawlers that rest on the bottom of the ocean as they search for fish, plowing the bottom of the ocean.
The ocean floor, of course, is where so much of the carbon is stored. It comes from the sea animals and their droppings.
And they can be kept there for hundreds of years if we don't disturb the bottom. And then comes the trawlers and they plow it and the carbon comes back up, increases climate change and messes up our weather.
So what is the carbon footprint of these giant fishing trawlers?
The amount of carbon released by bottom trawlers globally is equivalent to the CO2 that is pumped out by the aviation industry. Think about that.
Wow, the fishing trawlers release as much carbon as the entire aviation industry?
Yes. So we take them out, we'll save climate and improve the habitat so there will be more fish.
Why more fish?
What we find, all the research, and it's in this paper, as the world warms up, the ocean absorbs a lot of heat, and fish are like people. They have a range of temperature where they are comfortable. If it's too hot in your room, you open your window. It cools you down. The fish don't have this. If the temperature of the water they are in is getting too hot, they follow the cold water. So fish are leaving countries around the equator towards the poles, which means you are losing your livelihood also. So it's really crucial to take down climate change. And African countries can have a moral authority to push the world to do this, because really, Africans don't pollute much. But Africans really face the consequences from climate change, which will make the continent unlivable, which will be terrible and unfortunate, not only for Africans, but the world at large. So thinking comprehensively, what actions can we take in order to reduce climate change and get more food and also protect biodiversity? This is what this paper has outlined for the world and continents like Africa.
You said that you've seen the lessons of your own life story mirrored in this approach to stewardship. You grew up in Africa.
Absolutely. When I was growing up, our parents, our communities actually know how to sacrifice something today in order to get something tomorrow. Working hard day and night to make sure their daughter or son gets education in order to support the family and the community. And this is what we're talking about here. If you are not willing to really make some effort and make sacrifice today, your condition is going to continue getting worse. If we are brave enough to do what our mothers and aunties and our uncles and fathers have done through history, we will be in a better place. And that is what this protection of the ocean, 30% of it, is all about.
And just to connect this back to the trawlers for a second, aside from the carbon, I understand that what they do creates so much waste. It must be quite heartbreaking for you to see all that.
But I give you one example. Years ago, I was flown to Senegal to be part of the movie, The End of the Line. It's been described as the inconvenient truth of the ocean. We got on a boat one evening tracking a bottom trawler. Man, this thing broke my heart, because these guys, they are looking for shrimp, because shrimp is very valuable. Anything else they catch, they throw overboard. And we're following them with our little boat and seeing all these amazing animals being thrown out and destroyed. We collected some of them, came to the shore and did a barbecue with locals and having a pretty nice dinner. This is what they were wasting. And this breaks hearts. So yeah, this is tough, but my own way of tackling this is we have to be optimistic. We have to keep pushing, because if this makes all of us give up, then we're really going to go down, right? And remember, those who came before us, in fact, there are some of us who are thinking Africa should probably be the conservation continent, modern conservation that works for the people and works for nature, and do well as we do that.
That was Professor Rashida Sumaila, an interdisciplinary oceans and fisheries economist at the University of British Columbia, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I am Chinedofo in Washington. For all latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bongo flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the Int